are you?
Was that okay at the back?
Hello, what's that? Hello, what's that? Our speaker tonight is Abbot of Amravati Buddhist Centre, which is just north of Hemel Hempstead. And it's quite a big affair. There's probably now 20, 30 bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. And I don't really think there's two of you in the audience who don't know Amravati or our speaker, but for the two, he is a very, very welcome guest of ours tonight. Not only a very interesting and insightful speaker, but also a very humorous one. And as today he had bestowed on him a great honour, he would tonight like to talk on the title of his talk tonight will be The Godfather.
Is it this evening or true and fellow Buddhists or those who are interested in seeking the truth or realizing the truth? And this, even though this might seem a bit facetious, the title of this talk, actually the word God and Father are both very highly fraught words in the English language, and it's always good to contemplate what we mean and the effect that words have on us, because one of the problems with our human state is that we tend to be caught in reactions, conditioned reactions to things. So someone says God and somebody else reacts, either with great faith or with great aversion, indifference. Just the term father can mean to some people a tyrant or male chauvinism or all kinds of negative authoritarian images, or it can mean benevolence, patriarchal benevolence and justice and kindness. And as practitioners of Buddhism, practicing the Dhamma, and we want to know why things are as they are, how things affect this sensitive formation. Because being born as a human being means that we must live a lifetime incarcerated in this form with all that happens to it, all the possibilities of experience, both from the best to the worst possibilities. Now this is a conscious form and it's a sensitive form. So being born means that we become individual conscious beings. Isn't it? That's what birth means, really, as a human being. That's the same with the animals. They become individual conscious beings when an animal is born. Consciousness, then, is the experience of subject, of the subject and object, the feeling of the subject relating to an object. So consciousness always gives this impression of being a separate being. And in this separateness, we feel when we don't understand it and have not any insight into the true nature of things, then of course we tend to feel alienated, lost and separated, alone, lonely. because that's how it seems when the impression that one has of life is through trying to find an object that will ease this loneliness. Now the visual consciousness means that we tend to attach to what we see. When we look at something, we're conscious through the organ of the eye. Then, say, if we're very attached to what we see, we feel secure when we're in a place that we know, or with people whose faces are familiar, in countries or homes or whatever that we identify with as being part of me or mine or what is familiar to me. When you travel abroad, many people suffer from what they call culture shock, because what they see around them is not familiar. It's alien or foreign or strange, exotic, threatening to them, because their sense of security and that sense of security depends very much on what they see being familiar, what they're used to, familiar faces. Then in our minds we create, we have perceptions. So we have perceptions that we, like for example, some of you who are new to Buddhism feel the concepts or the perceptions we use are strange and alien. When we talk about Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and we talk about Sila, Samadhi, Panya, and Paticca Samuppada, and the Arya Atanga Magga and all of this, and what's he talking about? For those of you who are old veteran Buddhists, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But those who are new suddenly feel totally left out, don't you? You feel just like the stranger that doesn't know anything, and that can make you feel very much threatened or alienated or lonely. Nothing's more kind of lonely, isn't it, than being in a group of people who are talking about something you know nothing about. And they're talking even in jargon, in terms that you don't even know the meaning of. I just came from a conference in Cambridge. And I could experience that feeling in my heart. Feeling in my heart. Being left out of me. Now the conscious experience then is as long as we identify, say, with consciousness itself, or what we call the five khandhas, and this afternoon Malcolm was talking about in the Tibetan tradition they use the Sanskrit, so there's skandhas, and in Pali it's corrupt Sanskrit. Pali is corrupt Sanskrit. So we say khanda. It's probably like having a Cockney accent or something. So it's all due respect to Malcolm's precise pronunciation and classy accent, I will revert back to this lesser one, the five khandhas. Now, just investigate what the objective world is, say, as an individual human being. What we see, what we hear, smell, taste, and touch, say on the sensual plane. So these are very important to us, that what we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch, these affect our minds, don't they? If you see something, feel something, hear something, taste something that is pleasant, beautiful, lovely, in that, then you feel happy. You have a sense of well-being. It's a pleasant experience. And if and of course the opposite, if you see, hear, smell, taste, and touch something that is painful or ugly or unpleasant, then you have that experience of discomfort, unpleasantness, misery. So this is just the way it is as a human being when we're born as separate conscious beings. We experience pleasure and pain, beauty and ugliness, and of course so much of our experience is neither particularly beautiful nor painful. So much of life is rather neutral. But the sensory world is like this. Being sensitive and conscious means that we are must live this lifetime. For however long our bodies decide to live, we will be experiencing pleasure and pain, beauty and ugliness. Now, there's a very natural reaction. So just the way the sensory consciousness operates is to be attracted to the beautiful. That's what beauty is. It's what is attractive. If you're not attracted to the beautiful, there's something wrong with you. And to be repelled by the ugly is perfectly natural. It's not a neurotic problem with you. It's a perfectly natural feeling to feel repelled by the ugly, the painful. And it's very normal to seek the beautiful and the pleasurable and to avoid the painful and miserable, but to completely overlook the rather neutral ordinariness of life, because the modern society allows us all kinds of exciting, interesting, absorbing sensory experiences. We don't have the long periods of, say, in the old times when people maybe had to spend a long winter just knitting by the fire, or where there wasn't any television or any supermarket or any chance for a holiday in a tropical country during the winter time or anything like this. You just had to put up with English winter, sitting by the fire, reading the biography of my great-great-grandmother, who was a pioneer out in the Oregon territories in 1840. She had to make soap and candles, everything. Just day after day of just surviving as a pioneer. And yet you go, I was in Seattle last year. What a modern, fast, trendy city it has become. It is the yuppie capital now. Very smart. And yet, in 1840, it was not much. So the sensory world is this way. If we were just helpless victims of sensory conditioning, if we were just conditioned creatures, like just meant to just react to pleasure and pain, and that's all we could ever do with our lives, is just try to hold on, try to accumulate and hoard up beauty and pleasure, and push away and hold back the tides of pain and misery, and that's what so many people do with their lives, isn't it? Just an endless search, mad search, obsession with trying to hold on to some kind of familiar pleasure or security, and the worries and anxieties that haunt the human mind about the possibilities of misery and pain, even before they come to us, then we are truly pathetic creatures. That somehow being born as a human being is most unfortunate and sad situation, if that's all we're meant to do, is just try to hold on to the best and worry and feel threatened by all the possibilities of what we love and want being removed and taken away from us. But the uniqueness of our humanity is in its ability in the human mind to reflect. So in this being born as a human being, we're not just sensitive, conscious creatures, because the animal kingdom is equally sensitive and equally conscious. But the gift of our humanity is in the human mind's ability to reflect upon itself. In other words, and this is what Buddha means. The word Buddha literally means the knowing, the ability to know things as they are. And that's why you can make Buddha images, human-like images. Because Buddha is not just an abstract knowledge that doesn't relate to any form, but there are Buddhas, and Buddha is to me the word that always allows me to remember this reflective ability, the ability to contemplate the things that are going on in my mind, and the beauty and the ugliness and the neutrality that I experience as a conscious being. And by reflecting and contemplating existence, then we understand. There's insight, knowledge, ability to know and see the truth, which is in the position of the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, Buddha realizing the truth. So this relationship of Buddha to Dhamma is not just a kind of Buddhist doctrine, but if you contemplate from that position of Buddha being the awakened, the knowing, then there is the realization of the Dhamma. So like the refuges that Venerable Prakrutilananda gave to the little children today, with their parents taking them for them, then this is actually what we, putting it into a very practical, immediate position of knowing and seeing the truth right now. So that Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, or the Sangha being those who practice the Dhamma, those like we're Sangha, the Bhikkhu Sangha, Venerable Prakrutilananda and our Bhikkhu Sangha, but the Sangha also means those who practice the Dhamma, those who look and see and investigate and have insight into the Dhamma, or the ultimate truth, or the truth of the way it is. A reflective mind, then, is your capacity to contemplate your own experience, what is suffering. Like, say, somebody told me they felt very confused. To reflect on confusion is important part of our practice, because we do get confused, our minds get very confused. We hear one thing, somebody says one thing, somebody says another. And in a conference, of course, people are talking about their own particular emphasis or preference or intonation, so which might be very different, or maybe they mean the same thing, but the way they say things can be different than the way you're used to. So one just feels confused by all the different views, opinions, attitudes that you might be hearing at a seminar. But the immediacy of remembering Buddha Dhamma Sangha allows us to recognize the confusion. We can reflect, what is confusion like? To be confused, what does it feel like? Because confusion is, what rather than just struggling against it and trying to seek clarity, isn't it? Confusion is painful, it's unwanted. We don't like it. We don't want to be confused. We want to know and understand everything. But what we can know right now, at this moment, if there's confusion is this way. And we begin to accept the actual feeling and experience of being confused. And by doing that, confusion is not the ultimate reality. So it is definitely impermanent. And by not resisting or struggling with it, you begin to understand how to just let go of it. With things like greed and anger and jealousy and fear and all the human emotional states and attitudes that can go through a human mind during a day. Now, say the Western civilization is one that definitely affirms that these are personal attributes. People will always describe themselves, oh, I'm an angry person, or I'm a jealous person, or I'm a person with a lot of anxiety, or I'm a greedy person. And this way of thinking is normal Western conditioning, isn't it? It's not everybody in the Western world tends to think in these patterns. If you feel greed, they say, I'm greedy. If you feel angry, say, I'm angry. So the I am, the sense of me as a separate being, as an individual being, is then equated with the feeling in your mind or in your heart. So that if it's a bad feeling, then I'm a bad person. If it's a good feeling, I'm a good person. Then because we have memory, because we have this ability to remember, we have retentive memory, we can hold on to all these things and carry them around for a whole lifetime, from some experiences, attitudes you formed in childhood, say in your early years. I am a bad boy can actually be something that you can haunt you for the rest of your life if that somehow was a very traumatic memory in the past, a kind of haunting fear, I am a bad boy, can be like an unconscious or barely conscious phantom or specter that haunts you and follows you wherever you go. You go to church, you're a bad boy. When you go to a Buddhist conference, bad. I go to holiday in tropical paradise, the bad boy goes along. So this is now, notice that we are conscious and sensitive. We have the ability to create perceptions in our mind. So we perceive things, we have language. Sanya, sankhara in the five khandhas, so that we can create with our minds all kinds of illusions onto life. We can create ourselves. We can create a whole personality just with these words of I'm a bad boy, I should be, I shouldn't be, I am this, I am that, and these are maybe conventionally quite accurate. Say, I am a Buddhist monk. I was born in the United States. I am abbot of Amravati. I am. These are conventional realities, definitely, which are certainly nothing wrong or bad or even painful about it. But it's the judgments and the attachments, or the attachments that we form to these identities, that we suffer from. So that, say, I am a man, or I am a woman, if we're attached to that as an identity, as if one is that continuously all the time, then one is going to suffer from that attachment. Men, if you feel I am a man as an assumption for your lifetime, then if anything threatens manhood or your perceptions of what men should be or what a man is or what a woman is, then you suffer. You feel anxious, upset, angry, defensive about anything that threatens your identity as a man or a woman. There's a lot of that feeling now, isn't there? The what they call sexism and male chauvinism and feminism and all these are very much movements of the modern time that tend to be very much aimed at defending, justifying permanent positions within the roles of our gender. And so we suffer. We suffer from people sexist or male chauvinist or or feminist or all these kind of things can really get your back up in modern situations. Because that is, one assumes, doesn't it, that one is a permanent man or permanent woman. If one is attached to being a Buddhist, isn't it? We remember the old summer school days where, what are you? I'm Zen. definitely an assumption that one is permanently Zen or permanently Theravada, as if that was something, once you chose one, that was what you are forever, or you should be, and you shouldn't have anything to do with the others. Because that's what attachment does. I mean, it creates this sense of that I am this and that I can't be anything else. Or you adopt all the prejudices that are usually generate from a fixed position. So this is suffering, isn't it? Having a mind that remembers and creates all kinds of things. We because of this sensitivity and intelligence and retentive memory and consciousness, and we have to live like this for a lifetime with all this. And life becomes very complicated, doesn't it? It can be very, very complicated for us because we do create endless problems, even when there isn't really anything particularly threatening us in the moment. And this becomes very apparent in countries like this, where there is good government, and there is a kind of security, and there is democracy, and people do try to be fair, and there is just, people try to be just, people do care about each other, and there's innumerable charities and charitable organizations and institutions taking care of everything, from puppy dogs to kitty cats and rabbits and this is we always had a joke for a dog. If you've been a bad dog, you get reborn in India. If you've been a good dog, you're reborn in England. So you can threaten your dog and say, if you're bad, you know where. So in a country, say an affluent country like this, and in every affluent country it's the same, one is always still caught in thinking it should be better. I mean, we can still spend the evening complaining about the things wrong in this country and think that somehow if all those things were made better, and we've actually perfected Britain into the perfect democratic system where everything was completely just and fair. And it's exactly what we wanted, that somehow we would be really happy then. But I really don't think we would be. I think we'd find something to grumble about. It's too perfect. Remember the good old days? Everything's too fair in this country. I can't stand it. I'm going to live in India. So in the objective world, it's never satisfying to us. I mean, we never really get satisfaction from the objects of our life. I mean, just in relationships to other human beings, isn't it? We long for some kind of meaningful, fulfilling relationship with another person. And the romantic idea of meeting the one that was made for us, and like Prince Charming and Cinderella, and living happily ever after is a dream, a lovely dream we have. And yet, even when we do meet Cinderella or Prince Charming, and they're still, it's not completely satisfying. Because if we expect somebody else to satisfy us and take away our loneliness and fulfill us, we're asking something impossible. That's an impossibility. No one can do that for us. So you find endless discussions about relationships these days in Buddhist circles. Somehow, modern Buddhists of the Western world, they don't do this in Thailand, but in America, they're 100% relationship-oriented. And it's all this endless talking about how to work out this relationship, the idea that once you work it out, that you'll be happy with it, and everything will be wonderful. But it doesn't, because inevitably we get old, we die, things like this are just part of life's experience. And anyway, it's impossible. No one can truly satisfy me or fulfill me. It's an impossibility for anyone or everyone to do that. Once I realized that, then I no longer expected or longed for or demanded that as from somebody else, because I realized that was just being silly and foolish. Where before I was kind of hoping and expecting some kind of security and fulfillment through relationship with another person. Now that I don't mean that in a negative way, that relationships are unimportant or aren't worth anything. But I'm just pointing to that the fact that they, if we expect and demand the impossible from them, then they become meaningless, they become unpleasant, they become disastrous. And so people find it very difficult to live with each other if they have those expectations. So, say, in the developing the spiritual life, or the holy life, say the aim of a religious person, is not for earthly happiness or fulfillment of one's desires on this earth, or finding someone else who will completely satisfy me and make me feel and fulfill me in this life, but it's the aspiration, the longing, the ontological tendency. I got that one from this conference. The ontological tendency of the human mind, of the human being, for the ultimate, deathless, immortal reality. And as long as, and where so much of modern Buddhism in the Western world is, tends to be more therapeutic than transcendent. Then we hear more about, you know, working out our relationships through the Dhamma, or how to meditate together and live happily ever after, or whatever. The idea of a very earthbound, having a green peace, ecologically balanced, perfect relationship, perfect society, cooperative with everything, all kind of together, and that on this planet somehow one expects to live long enough to experience a ecological balance and a perfect relationship. And yet, you know, we realize that not only are human beings quite capable of destroying the ecology and polluting the planet, but we also realize that Mother Nature does a lot of harm too. As far as we're concerned, volcanoes and all these and hurricanes and cyclones and floods and you name it. I mean, we're living in this on this beautiful planet, but it, Mother Nature also can take a pretty strong hand and beat us up. It's not totally the fault of the human the greedy human being. Now the religious, say religion or religion, is its purpose and aim is the same. Now I'm making this assertion. Now, and this is, even though some people would not agree with this, but I make this assumption because in Buddha Dhamma, there's a very clear pattern that the Buddha established, which is, I think, probably one of the most clear statement, metaphysical statements ever made by a human being, which amounts to there is the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, which means the immortal, the deathless. And if there was not this uncreated, unborn, unoriginated, there could not be the created, the born, and the originated. But because there is the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, there is the created, the born, the originated. Now that is a paradigm, isn't it? I would say the conditioned to the unconditioned. And then in his teaching of the Four Noble Truths, this marvelous teaching he gave, this pattern is investigated till it is fully realized. The born with the unborn, the created with the uncreated. Now how can you contemplate that? Now we have reflexive minds, don't we? We've already establish that the unique position of a human being is that we can reflect on ourselves. We can contemplate, why am I alive? What is life about? Why was I born? What will happen to me when I die? What will happen when I die? Like when Danish says, hostile, the idea of people, why die? Why do we have to die? Or what is death about? Is a question about our what happens to us when these bodies don't live anymore. And there's an anguish in there because if we're attached to the experience of being born and sensory consciousness, then without this we become very frightened. We think, if I don't have eyes, what's the purpose? I mean, you're dead, and then what? If you don't have a body, and you don't have ears, and you don't have a tongue, and you don't have feelings or memories or any of this, well, I just can't imagine what it would be like. And so it becomes the unknown, and the unknown always has a sense of terror involved. What is the mystery? The unknown, what is in the dark, that vast dark universe out there, what is it all about? Well, that ability to ask those kind of questions is unique to the human situation, as far as we know, isn't it? There might be other beings on Mars or something, but I don't know about them. But I don't see the cat at Amravati asking those kind of questions. Nice cat. But it's not particularly into reflecting on Dhamma, more kind of chasing after mice and demanding food. So I understand that too. I mean, it's not beyond my experience of life. So being human being then is the opportunity, and in Buddhist terms, being born as a human being is a great gift in the Buddhist world. In Thailand, for example, the Thais generally regard human birth as a great gift. It's a very good thing to be born as a human being. Now, I used to seriously doubt that, because I thought, I considered life a bit of a bad joke, actually, before I was a monk. And I didn't see any point to it, and it seemed to be, you know, rather silly, clumsy, foolish thing to have to put up with for a lifetime, being human. And so therefore when I went to Thailand and I heard this, I was a bit cynical at first. But then through the actual practice of the Dhamma and through the meditation, I began to appreciate that attitude and realize the value and the gift that's been offered to me as having been born as a human being, and having an opportunity to hear the Dhamma, having an opportunity to practice the Dhamma in order to free the mind from delusion. And so contemplating this, the born with the unborn, the created with the uncreated, in our practice of meditation, as you develop your reflexive mind more and more, using the teachings of the Buddha, that's what they're for. They're not doctrinal positions to take on life. If you attach to them, you're misusing them. They are to take, to study, to investigate, to apply to your own experience as an individual being. And so in an ordinary daily life situation, what is the relationship of the created to the uncreated? It arises and ceases. Or what arises and ceases? And you begin to notice this arising and ceasing of the conditioned realm. Thoughts, memories, the sensory consciousness itself, all of the subtleties of the conditioned realm, you begin to notice and reflect on. You notice they're arising. And they arise through grasping desires out of ignorance. You begin, and as you realize that, then you let go. You realize you have the insight into letting go of things, not holding on, not hanging on to things. And when you let go of things, then they cease. And that is where you actually realize the created ceasing in the uncreated. So if you're in the actual experience of mindfulness, that is the connection to the uncreated, the unborn, the immortal. It's in, and this the Buddha said in a verse in the Dhammapada, appamado amattapadam. This appamado amattapadam is mindfulness is the way to the deathless. Appamado amattapadam. Amattapadam is the deathless. Pamado machuno padang. And heedlessness is the way to death. Appamado namiyandi ye pamadaya tamadaha. These two last two lines are mindfulness is the same, is never die. And heedlessness is forever die, or is the same as death. Heedlessness is the same as death. Body is yourself, then the result of that is that you're going to get old, you're going to get sick, you're going to die. So if you are your body, then the result of that attachment is that you have the feeling. You have the feeling, you make the assumption you get old and you get sick and you die. And if you're attached to the sensory realm and hang on to it, or to views and opinions and ideas, then the result is grief and despair and anguish, sorrow. So that's the result. The suffering is the result of that attachment through ignorance. And the way out of suffering is through mindfulness, appamado amattapadam. Mindfulness is the way to the amattapadam, the immortal realization of immortality. Now that, don't think of immortality, because any thought is mortal. But as you're mindful, as you begin to really practice and cultivate and awaken to life that you're living in all its forms, in all its qualities, and see it and understand it and see the cessation. And it ceases in here, isn't it? It's this mind. We're each the center of the universe in this lifetime. You have to accept that. You are the center of the universe for this lifetime. And the universe is like this. It impinges on. How much control we have over it, say, I only want nice things to impinge on me. You know, as much as I might like that, I like nice things to impinge on me. And as much as I try to control everything so that only the nice things impinge on me, there's always something else impinging on me too. And you give up trying to control it all, because that's even more suffering. But through mindfulness and understanding the Dhamma, seeing things as they are, then you can bear with the pain, the sickness, the aging process, the death, the loss of loved ones. You can, those are all completely endurable, bearable experiences. We can free the mind from anguish and despair by understanding, by knowing things as they are. We needn't be caught in just an endless despair and lost in loneliness and sorrow. We can actually be free from that through right understanding, through seeing that all that is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. And then the anatta, the not-self, isn't annihilation of you. It's not a denial of the true subject, but it's a true realization that you're not really a mortal, conditioned creature, helpless, lost in a mysterious universe, forced to experience pleasure and pain, and not be any the wiser for it. That is your heritage as a human being, to realize this ultimate realization of Nibbana. We say in one of those exotic words in the Pali. So I think I've...
quite long enough.
Pabakro and Tamananda.
Well, you're also a source of inspiration to quite a lot of others. I'd like to thank you very, very much for your talk tonight. So. Just have you 1 second, please. In some of the rooms or in some of the literature, it says, would you get your baggage out of your room by 9 o'clock? Well, there's no other conference tomorrow because we're here for most of the day. And this is not an announcement about the end of the seminar or anything like that, because that's not until late tomorrow. But you can leave your bags in your room. Now, also though, if there are people going off in the morning, you must hand your keys in. If the key goes missing, there's a £5 fine. That's just from the centre. What you get from us is something else. Later tonight, there's going to be a slideshow in the Bindapart room, if we can find a white sheet. If not, it'll be on the wall, but it's on... Is it India and Nepal?
Yeah.
India and Nepal. And I think we'll get it set up. We've got a projector, but unfortunately I sent the screen home last night. I showed this kid.
Do we need the keys where we collected them?
Well, we'll organise it. Yeah. Right. But it's just that if you're going early, then give the keys to Diana or myself.
Yes.
John, did you made your announcement, didn't you?
I did indeed.
Well, that's all, folks.